Well, the US needs to pressure the Bolivian government to take the peaceful democratic route out of this crisis, which is to accept elections as soon as possible, but without the persecution that they've been carrying out against the mass, against leftist candidates. And if they can do that, then that is the only way that Bolivia can overcome this crisis in a peaceful way. The other option is a forcible overthrow of the government or a brutal state crackdown on the protests and the general strike.
Ali Vargas, we want to thank you for being with us. Journalist with Causachan News, joining us from Cochabamba, Bolivia. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman with Noreen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
To KBOO Portland.
Time to think fast, the movement. Learn lessons from my past, the movement.
KBOO is holding a training this Saturday, August 15th, for KBOO volunteers interested in covering protests in our city for the KBOO Evening News. The training will be virtual as the station remains closed due to the ongoing pandemic. If you are interested in learning how to cover protests as a KBOO street reporter, contact our news director by emailing newsdirector@kboo.org. That email is newsdirector@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, evacuations are ordered after a wildfire breaks out in the Columbia River Gorge, the Umatilla COVID-19 outbreak continues to grow, and do black demonstrators think their message has been hijacked? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 13th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The trajectory of Black Lives Matter protests in Portland has been a varied one. Since the introduction of federal agents last month, some have argued that the protests have gotten off message. They say that the focus has shifted away from the fight for racial justice, just when it's needed most. KBOO's Michael Leverett was at the protests last night. They spoke with black demonstrators about the state of the protest message and how they keep their fight alive.
I think it's positive change, you know what I mean? I feel like it's definitely time for a change, you know what I mean? And like the protests, as far as the protest goes, like without reform or whatever, you know what I mean, nothing's gonna change until things, you know what I mean, come together and higher up, you know what I mean. So as far as that goes,
Do you feel like the message is still on track? Do you feel like it's been hijacked slightly?
Yeah, it has been hijacked. I feel that way. The whole idea really is kind of hijacked in a way, you know, as far as people with their own agenda, you know what I mean. So just taken away from what the original purpose was. So. Yeah.
If you had one message when all this is all done with, because you know it all dies down eventually and stuff, what would that be to keep, like, especially black folks going and motivated?
Just keep the power to the people, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? Just keep an open mind, positive vibes, and so, yeah, for sure.
I think it's gone in a really weird direction where people have lost focus of what it's about and things that are happening out here. aren't done by African Americans for the most part. It's done by other races from other places. People are showing videos of things that are happening in Russia and saying that it's here. It's completely ass backwards. Mm-hmm.
So you feel like the message has been hijacked?
It's been completely hijacked. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like more black people need to show up and step up, or you feel like this is their work to be doing, they just need to stay on message?
They need to show up and step up. However, it's hard to do here. It's really hard to do here.
So we know, like, these things usually die down and everything usually returns back to normal. So what would you say to black people to keep them motivated to keep the movement going so we can finally see some justice and reform happen?
See something, say something. Show up, be there for each other, build each other up, build up our community. When we see something that's happening that it doesn't reflect us, it's scary as hell trying to, like, what are the cops going to do? You know what I mean? Who is going to react in what type of way to what's happening? But we just have to, and it's scary, but nothing will change until we solidify ourselves in a way that isn't violent and isn't angry and depicts who we are. We are proud. We are black. We are strong. We are intelligent as whoa. So until we start making people see it that way, they're not really going to look at us for that.
It's almost like it's like an international, it's a global fight we're fighting. And so when you start locally, it gets to a more global stage. And so I want to see change happen. Like, the more they see us out here on the daily, like, you know, our efforts that we put in, they know we're serious, and then we'll see the change we're looking for. Because we're not here based on, like, how they say we're here for. Like, they think we're here for violence and to, like, you know, overthrow their government or something like that. But we're just really looking for fairness and equality. Okay. I'm going to be honest, I feel like it's coming back to it more. A few weeks ago, I felt like, oh, is it really still centered around Black Lives Matter? But I've been seeing that it's coming more centralized back to that now. I think it kind of got carried away a little bit. I think with the feds being here, it kind of, like, you know, trying to change, like, the view a little bit. But I feel like now we're getting back on track, moving around, actually marching and stuff. And we missed marching for a couple months. Just know that the fight is not over. Know that your life matters, that we all matter, and that it's only a matter of time till we do see the change, because all this fight will not be for nothing. You know.
Right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. You have a nice night, okay? Be safe.
That was KBOO's Michael Leverett speaking with black demonstrators in Portland at last night's protest. Portland State University announced that it will disarm its public safety officers, reversing a decision from October 2019. PSU students and staff have been pushing the university administration to disarm campus police since 2018. That's when two campus police officers shot and killed Jason Washington. He was a 45-year-old black man who was trying to break up a bar fight when police shot and killed him. Washington had a concealed carry permit, and while breaking up the fight, his weapon fell from its holster and onto the ground. A grand jury ruled the officers in question were acting in self-defense, though the Portland State Student Union maintains that Washington was a victim of racial profiling. Campus police at PSU have been armed since 2015, but now the administration says it will reimagine safety on campus. University President Stephen Percy made a statement on the university website, saying, quote, "The calls for change that we are hearing at PSU are ringing out across our nation. We must find a new way to protect the safety of our community, one that eliminates systemic racism and promotes the dignity of all who come to our urban campus." In Bend, Oregon yesterday, activists got word that several immigrant workers were being put on a bus for possible deportation. The activists mobilized and began blocking the bus. The action began with just a couple people standing in front of the bus, but within an hour, over 100 people had arrived. By evening time, 5 hours into the standoff, over 500 people had gathered, including city council members and the local district attorney. Here's how protesters questioned the district attorney.
hey, maybe you should come here. Your city is literally here upset and that she's not here. Don't you think that's
well, I mean, there's 100 things that I could do that I'm doing. I'm answering your questions.
I talked to
the police officers. I tried to talk to the ICE officers. I talked to a city. That's on my list. Yeah. Thank you.
I think that that should be on the top of your list because everybody that's here right now wants to know why our mayor's not here.
Well, that's not top of my list. My top of my list is trying to talk to the ICE officers and seeing if they can release the people. They wouldn't talk to me. Next on my list is talking to the Bend police officer in charge about what was happening. And so, you know, we have different priorities, but yes, I think on the list is
what information were you given by the police officers about what they're doing?
Yeah, I wanted to know if Bend police were involved in coordinating with ICE and helping to capture these people, detain them, put them on the buses. One, I was told no, and two, I believe it based on the level of detail I was given and the trust I have with the officer.
Trust for Bend PD.
That was Deschutes County District Attorney John Hummel, who represents the area around Bend, speaking to protesters yesterday. He said he had talked to Bend police about the cases, and one of the protesters asked him, "You trust the Bend police?" Today, local groups condemned what they called the kidnapping of the workers.
So my name is Adriana Miranda. I'm the executive director of CAUSA, Oregon Immigrant Rights Organization. CAUSA has been around for 25 years, doing exactly what you all did last night, protecting the life, the rights of our immigrant communities across Oregon. We believe in fairness.
Yes.
Yes.
And looking out for our neighbors.
Yes.
Because we are your brothers, we're your sisters, we're your nurses, we're your caregivers.
Yes.
Immigrant Oregonians are part of our families, our communities, our workplaces, and places of worship. And like many of our families, they join the long American tradition of coming here in search of a better life and the freedom and the opportunity that this great country has to offer.
As the protest yesterday continued to grow, federal officers arrived in riot gear, and a Department of Homeland Security surveillance airplane was seen circling the area. The two men were taken from the bus by federal agents to an unknown location. The main organizers of yesterday's action, the Central Oregon Peacekeepers, say the struggle is not over to protect members of the Bend community. They have vowed to take up the cases of the two men to ensure that they are returned to their families. Umatilla County is coping with some of the worst workplace outbreaks of COVID-19 in Oregon. Cases continue to climb in Oregon, Washington, and throughout the world, and a dire warning about the virus from the CDC. KBOO's Annette Newell has these and more stories in this COVID-19 update.
There are 294 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 in Oregon today, and 8 new deaths from the virus. This raises the state's death toll to 383, the Oregon Health Authority reported today. So far, there have been more than 22,000 people confirmed with the disease in Oregon. Multnomah County leads the state with 84 new cases, followed by Washington County with 36 and Marion County with 35. Umatilla County posted an extra 20 cases. Umatilla County's had an especially difficult toll from the virus for a county its size. It's had more than 2,300 confirmed cases and 31 deaths. Umatilla is coping with big outbreaks in workplaces, especially at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution with 199 cases. Food packing and agricultural work sites in the county have also suffered, including Lamb Weston, the potato processing company where they've counted 170 infected workers. Even though its population is only 78,000 people, Umatilla County suffered 10 of the 21 largest active outbreaks in Oregon and more than a quarter of the workplace outbreaks throughout the state. This week, the Oregon Health Authority reported 21 active outbreaks in Umatilla County infecting 725 people. Contrast that to Clackamas County, which has 5 times the population but just 136 cases. 2 weeks ago, Governor Kate Brown put the county back to stage 0, which means a stay-home order. In Washington state, as of this afternoon, there have been 64,702 confirmed cases, 1,724 deaths, and more than 6,000 hospitalizations since the pandemic began. In the United States, the deaths have soared to 166,148, with more than 5.2 million confirmed cases. Throughout the world, scientists have counted more than 750,000 lost lives and almost 20.7 million cases. The 5,236,599 cases in the United States continue to lead the world, according to the latest numbers from Johns Hopkins University, followed by Brazil with 3.1 million and India with about 2.4 million, then Russia with 905,000 counted COVID-19 infections. The Centers for Disease Control this afternoon issued a dire warning for the fall about the coronavirus. A top federal health leader is telling people to follow recommended coronavirus measures or risk having the worst autumn in U.S. public health history. Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the U.S. CDC, says, quote, "For your country right now and for the war that we're in against COVID-19, I'm asking you to do four simple things. Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands, and be smart about crowds. I'm not asking some of America to do it. We all got to do it." Meantime, Dr. Anthony Fauci with the National Institute of Allergies and Diseases said today, quote, "You can't run away from the numbers of people who've died, the number of people getting hospitalized, the surges we're seeing." For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
The Mosier Creek wildfire, likely human-caused, has grown to about 800 acres in the Columbia River Gorge. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has declared an emergency. The Wasco County Sheriff put out evacuation orders impacting people in 900 homes. Mosier is east of Hood River and west of the Dalles. At the scene, 150 homes were under the most serious level 3 evacuation order, which means go immediately. Another 500 are under level 2, which means be set to go, and 250 more are at level 1, or be ready. The Oregon State Fire Marshal is in charge of firefighting operations. Task forces from 8 counties were called in to help today. 24 jurisdictions across the country have ranked choice voting. As Eric Tegedoff reports, now some groups in Washington are pushing for the option too.
Voting rights groups want Yakima County residents to rank candidates in elections. How would that benefit the county? Latino community members and other groups have sued the Board of Yakima County Commissioners under the Washington Voting Rights Act, alleging the current election system disenfranchises the large Latino population. Colin Cole with the group More Equitable Democracy says under ranked choice, winning candidates would need to get at least 25% of votes. He says under this new system, if a voter's preferred candidate failed to reach that threshold, their second choice would move to the top of their list.
If you can walk into an ice cream shop and you ask for, you know, Rocky Road and they say they don't have it, if you understand that you don't have to leave the store because you have a second choice, if you get that, you get ranked choice voting.
Latinos make up about half of the county's population. For its countywide elections of 3 seats, Latinos have only won a seat once. The city of Yakima faced a similar issue and drew districts to create better representation. But Cole notes Latinos are widely dispersed throughout the county, making districts less effective. Aaron Hamlin with the Center for Election Science says there are many varieties of ranked choice voting. He says the process has to be well explained and transparent to the public to work effectively, but has potential to create better representation.
It would definitely give people more of a sense of involvement and empowerment and seeing that through their vote, they're actually having a meaningful outcome in terms of making sure that people who represent them are being elected.
Robin Engel with One America says the Latino population in Yakima County has been frustrated with the commission, especially in response to COVID-19, which is disproportionately affecting Latinos.
We heard again and again that the county commission doesn't represent the Latino community, doesn't invest in the Latino community, and that just the way that the democracy is working in Yakima County isn't working.
The Board of Yakima County Commissioners is being sued under the Washington Voting Rights Act, but could settle the case. Commissioners have expressed interest in working with the community to come up with a solution. 24 jurisdictions across the country have adopted ranked choice voting. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the North Portland Tenants Collective and their efforts to save the historic Flanders Building. At 6, we'll hear Rose City Native Radio, then at 8, Soul to Soul. Tonight's weather will be clear skies down to a low of 55. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny, up to 88 for the high. Today in history, on this date in 1997, South Park's first episode aired. Now it's still going strong in season 23. The quote of the day is from the South Park character Chef, who said, quote, "Don't do drugs, kids. There's a time and a place for everything. It's called college." Joe Biden and Kamala Harris make their first appearance as running mates, and President Trump calls a Georgia candidate a star despite her support for a baseless conspiracy theory. Here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I am incredibly honored by this responsibility, and I'm ready to get to work.
California Senator Kamala Harris and former Vice President Joe Biden made their first appearance as running mates at a local high school in Wilmington, Delaware, yesterday.
Joe, I'm so proud to stand with you, and I do so mindful of all the heroic and ambitious women before me whose sacrifice, determination, and resilience makes my presence here today even possible.
Biden's response to a barrage of attacks against Harris from President Trump and Fox News anchors and talk show hosts, quote, "We have to have her back."
Whining is what Donald Trump does best, better than any president in American history. Is anyone surprised Donald Trump has a problem with a strong woman or strong women across the board?
Speaking out against the president's handling of the coronavirus crisis, civil unrest, and other issues, the new ticket also announced an all-time record for online political contributions. Act Blue, the Democrats' fundraising site, reported processing $30 million in the 24 hours after Harris was selected.
We had our best grassroots fundraising day of the campaign, more than double our previous record.
If Biden and Harris are elected, California Governor Gavin Newsom gets to appoint a new senator to finish up her term through the 2022 election. UC Berkeley political scientist Eric Schickler says there are lots of prospects.
Newsom will face a hard choice in which there are just a number of considerations thinking about the future of the party and the state.
Schickler says California already has a lot of influence in the National Democratic Party, with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi coming from the Bay Area.
What the Speaker can accomplish given a Republican president is far more limited. And so, you know, certainly the idea of having Speaker Pelosi in the House and then Kamala Harris in the Vice President's office, you know, would position California extremely well under a Biden-Harris administration.
Calling Georgia's Marjorie Taylor Greene a, quote, "future Republican star," unquote, for her runoff victory, Trump also amplified the House candidate's support for QAnon, a baseless online phenomenon alleging a mysterious deep state plot against Trump.
I mean, there's a clear link between Trump's rhetoric and QAnon.
University of Miami Professor Joe Yasinski studies conspiracy theories and why people believe them.
I mean, when we poll on who likes QAnon, what we find is that it's people who despise the political establishment and think everything is a conspiracy. And this matches Trump's rhetoric perfectly. I mean, his campaign slogan was "drain the swamp. Everything's corrupt."
Nick Pennyman from Nonprofit Issue One says draining the swamp is one of Trump's broken promises. So far, 14 of Trump's aides, donors, or advisors have been indicted or gone to prison.
He did quite the opposite, in fact. He's appointed more lobbyists to executive branch positions, 300 lobbyists, than any president in history.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Today is Black Women's Equal Pay Day. It symbolizes how long into the year Black women must work to make as much as what white men made the previous year. On average, Black women are paid 21% less than white men, so Black women had to work an extra 7.5 months this year on top of the 12 months last year just to make as much that male workers did in 2019. The National Women's Law Center estimates that Black women lose out on about $1 million of income over their careers. Equal Pay Day for women overall was March 31st of this year. The Bay Mills Indian community will intervene in a pipeline fight. With that story and more, we go to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Bay Mills Indian community on Wednesday was granted the right to intervene in an ongoing Michigan pipeline fight with tribes, environmental groups, and community members. A judge's decision allows the tribe to take part in a case proceeding evaluating a permit application from the energy company Enbridge to the Michigan Public Service Commission. According to a press release from Earth Justice, which is representing the tribe, this is the first time a tribal nation has intervened in a proceeding before the Michigan Public Service Commission. The regulatory agency is determining if a tunnel will be built under waterways for the relocation of a segment of the Line 5 pipeline. Tribes are concerned about the environment, water, fisheries, and religious and cultural sites. In a statement, Bay Mills Chairman Brian Newland said the pipeline puts treaty rights and way of life at risk. Line 5 is a 645-mile pipeline which carries oil and natural gas, traveling through Michigan, Wisconsin, and Canada. The company maintains the pipeline is safe. The Michigan Public Service Commission has scheduled a virtual public hearing to gather comments on August 24th. Indian educators say they're in a tough bind in preparing for classes this fall. Many tribal communities continue to be under COVID-19 orders. Schools on the Lower Brule Reservation in South Dakota serve about 300 K-12 students and are not taking any chances. Superintendent Lance Witte says distance learning has its own problems because of internet access, and many families live in crowded arrangements. Educators know the risk they face in fully reopening.
We're facing some health concerns here that are probably not as prevalent off the reservation.
Witte says they're starting the year with mostly distance learning, but students will be able to come in for evaluations with their teachers. In the meantime, he says they're focused on making sure students are prepared.
Well, this will be the first time our students have had devices at their homes.
Witte says they'll keep monitoring COVID-19 to help make decisions about how to operate classes. The Red Lake Tribal Council in Minnesota recently established a COVID-19 relief fund. Enrolled Red Lake citizens can apply for assistance. Chairman Darrell Seeke explained the program in a video message.
The program provides for a payment in amount of $1,000 to each Red Lake enrolled adult who was 18 on or before July 31st, 2020. Applicants for the payment need to certify that they have suffered economic impacts through increased expenditures and or decreased income as a result of COVID-19.
The funds are intended to help people with rent, food, or other emergency costs due to the pandemic. The tribe is continuing to operate under COVID-19 emergency orders. This week, there were 43 positive cases reported on the reservation. A second round of COVID-19 mass testing is underway Thursday for tribal citizens. New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall and Congresswoman Deb Haaland are taking part in a Native Vote panel Thursday afternoon. The virtual panel discussion will focus on protecting voting rights in tribal communities. The lawmakers are expected to discuss the need to ensure Native people have access to polls and address voting during COVID-19. Other panelists include representatives from the Native American Voters Alliance Education Project and Let America Vote. 23 federal tribal broadband grants have been awarded for 2020. The national tribal broadband grants are intended to help communities develop or expand high-speed internet. The funds range from $40,000 to $50,000 for tribal communities across the country. The program is under the Interior Department's Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Experts say at least $116 billion are needed to equip public schools with COVID-19 personal protective equipment, like masks, plexiglass, and cleaning supplies. But as Eric Galatis reports, some teachers have to pay out of their own pockets.
As students head back to school, some Colorado teachers are raising their hands with safety concerns. Denver area 8th grade STEM teacher Kevin DePasquale says he's eager to be back in the classroom with his students, but he does not believe all schools are prepared to reopen safely due to a lack of resources and the absence of a cohesive national strategy. DePasquale says teachers have had to find their own personal protection equipment and pay out of pocket.
Today I picked up face shields for masks for further PPE protection, and my students are coming on Monday. The rest of my building is still waiting for plexiglass dividers.
Safety concerns over reopening schools have been downplayed by the Trump administration. President Donald Trump has claimed that the coronavirus does not pose a large risk for children. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has stated, without evidence, that children block COVID-19. In the final 2 weeks of July, more than 97,000 U.S. children tested positive for the coronavirus, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association. At least 86 children have died from COVID-19 since May. DePasquale does not think risks to children should be taken lightly.
When we have certain areas of our country that are shutting down because it's just not safe, but schools are being encouraged or even sometimes strong-armed into opening, it points to a larger issue of the value of education and educators in our country today.
The American Federation of Teachers estimates that at least $116 billion is needed for masks, plexiglass, cleaning supplies, test kits, and other safety measures to stop the virus's spread. In May, the U.S. House passed the HEROES Act, which includes funding for schools, but aid packages stalled in the Senate. President Donald Trump signed a series of executive orders last weekend, but none addressed public school funding. In the meantime, DePasquale says teachers and staff will do their best and bear extra costs to stay safe. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Gladys.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 13th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Janka Soderberg and Michael Leverett. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Eric Tegadoff, Eric Galatis, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be discussing the North Portland Tenants Collective.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
In the midst of a pandemic, when many are struggling to pay for rent, local developers are planning to demolish what has been called the Flanders Home, located at 2124 Northwest Flanders Street within the upcoming year. The house is home to 14 tenants and provides something unique in Portland: an affordable place to rent, including for those living on a fixed income. The Flanders House is an old home painted in blue with cream-colored trimming. Its history goes as far back as the late 1800s, when during a time of serious anti-Semitism, its owner was Nathan Simon, a Jewish lawyer in town. 2 years ago, the home was purchased by developers Elliot Gassner and David Peckham, who planned on demolishing the home and constructing a new 5-story, 19-unit apartment building to be rented at market rate. So far, it is unclear when Gassner and Peckham will carry out this plan for a new apartment complex. While neither owner has said what the going rate will be for an apartment at the new complex, last November, Oregon Live reported that the median cost for a one-bedroom apartment in Portland was $1,133. In response to the demolition of the home and rebuilding of a new apartment complex, the North Portland Tenants Collective, which formed last March after a group of tenants living in the Kenton neighborhood were told by their landlord rent payments were still expected despite the coronavirus pandemic, have unified to push back against the redevelopment of the Flanders House. On July 27th, during the City of Portland's Historic Landmarks Commission hearing, Portlanders testified via Zoom to the commissioners. One of the owners of the home, Elliot Gassner, explained during the hearing that the plan was to demolish the home for years and that tenants signed leases knowing this. Gassner cited various structural and foundational issues with the home and that renovation would not be enough to fix costly needed repairs. For some residents, as long as a decade, the Flanders House has been a safe haven for those who couldn't afford to live anywhere else in Portland. As will be discussed later in the program, for more than one tenant, this made the difference between being homeless and having an affordable place to rent. My guest today, Rebecca Markley, is a member of the North Portland Tenants Collective and is opposed to the planned redevelopment of the Flanders House. Here's my conversation with Rebecca about the organization's goal, her takeaways from the Historic Landmarks Commission hearing, and the planned demolition of the Flanders House. Rebecca, can you tell me, how did you get involved in the Flanders House?
We got involved with the Flanders House by just some, you know, like basic network connections. Someone had heard about what we were doing as like a smaller like tenant organization that was, you know, focused on direct action. They reached out to us. Her name was Zainab, and she was contacting us on behalf of a neighbor who was in this house that was going through the process to begin redevelopment. And so I think it was like a couple of weeks ago we met with Zainab and then the tenant who was concerned about what was happening, essentially, because they the house kind of like by fluke almost has remained really, really affordable for the area. And the development that was supposed to, you know, replace it is going to be all like market rate apartments and lots of, I guess there was a concern that there might be a threat of homelessness for some of the tenants who live there because of the house and like the nature of the house, the age of the house, all those kinds of things. They're sort of like losing one of the few instances of real affordable housing that's not subsidized just by like nature of you know the leases that have been honored for years was going to go away. And so with sort of with that background, with that tenant perspective, we decided to sort of like kind of like put together and reach out to the other tenants in the building. We sent letters to them. Nobody got back to us, and that's fine. We did have two people who did live in the house come forward and provide their own testimony. One was in favor of the redevelopment, and one was against the redevelopment. And yeah, that's just kind of like how that started. But we really want to be able to like help people realize that they do have organizing power, that like they aren't alone in this crisis. As much as like capitalism does a great job of making us all feel alone, as much as property management companies want to deal with individual problems on an individual basis, like these are problems that really do affect all of us. And when we can work together, you know, we were able to pull together a pretty large response to the public testimony or the public hearing on Monday. Yeah, it was only like the six of us who were really directly involved as part of the organizing team, but you know, we were able to get Street Roots to notice. We were able to get the Neighborhood Association to take notice, and all together we're able to really like hopefully make a difference and hopefully at least delay the redevelopment until after, you know, the threat of the pandemic has like, you know, lapsed. Because like there are people who are immunocompromised who live in that building, and it's not fair for them to have to leave because the owner suddenly decides right now, today is the day that I decide I want to build my new apartment building. They could just, you know, delay that a few years.
For tenant Aaron Dawson, who shared his experience at the July Historic Landmarks Commission hearing, the Flanders House allowed him to no longer sleep in his car while also working a full-time job. Here's Aaron Dawson's testimony.
My name is Aaron Dawson. I've been living in 2124 Northwest Flanders for just over a year now. When I first moved to Portland in March of 2018, I was actually living out of my car while still working full-time until I moved into the apartment I'm in now. The affordability of the small unit I'm in was pretty essential to me and my stability then, and it still is today. I've actually been able to use the stability here to focus on my career and build for my future since I moved in. But I've been able to live very comfortably here while still saving. Like Joel said at the beginning of the testimonies, I also moved in this unit being told that it would be torn down eventually, so this is not a surprise at all. I feel like we've been given plenty of time to prepare for this, and I'm not against the construction of new housing, and I also totally welcome an increase to housing density in any neighborhood. And as a resident of the building, I'm inclined to agree with Elliot's comments earlier that it just makes more sense to replace the building rather than continue to renovate it. I'm not under the impression that a historical building should be kept around forever. If it's possible to replace it with something that would give more people homes than the original building. That being said, however, I'm also completely aware that as of early 2019, statistics show that 16,000 apartments in the Portland metro area are vacant, which is over 4 times the number of homeless people in the area, which was a statistic that I belonged in not long ago. I make above minimum wage with a full-time job, but a studio apartment that isn't well over half my monthly income is exceedingly rare in this area. If 2124 Northwest Flanders is going to be destroyed and rebuilt with new units, then it needs to be built to give affordable housing opportunities to the unhoused, and it must also avoid contributing to the 16,000 vacant dwellings that already exist in our community. And if the monthly rent of the new buildings meets market value or is above that, it would still take well over half the income of people at or slightly above minimum wage. It doesn't meet any of those criteria, and it would like really add to a growing housing crisis. Earlier, I heard Brian specifically mention wanting to make sure more units were being added than were taken away. But if you're taking away affordable units to make room for units that are inaccessible to the majority of Portlanders, then you're not actually adding any units at all, since there are already thousands of available units for the class of people who could afford at or above market value apartments. I know that renting accessibility and pricing wasn't discussed today, but I think it's really crucial to the planning. Your decision could easily put me back to living in my car, so I hope that's taken very seriously. Thank you.
Unlike what some might expect looking in at this story, not all residents are against the demolition of the home. One resident, Joel, says he has lived at the site the longest, for 12 years, and believes this issue has been blown out of proportion, and that he says he has been given plenty of notice, even before the house was purchased 2 years ago, that the home would eventually be demolished. Here is Joel's testimony.
I've lived here longer than anybody. My name is Joel Drummond. I live at 2124 Northwest Flanders. I've lived here for almost 12 years. I've lived here longer than anyone else in the building. And I wasn't going to speak at first today, but I was shocked that the article in Street Roots and the North Portland Tenant Commission and a couple of neighbors in the neighborhood who have turn this whole thing into this David and Goliath struggle against Elliot Ganser in particular. Nobody came to talk. They based all this on one person's testimony. They didn't come to talk to the other residents in the building. And so it's they put flyers everywhere, and it's become this big old thing that it shouldn't be. He's an excellent landlord. He's always, his only concern is, are we comfortable? And then he lets us know what's going to happen, you know, well in advance of it happening, that sort of thing. So that was mostly the focus of what I had to say, just the whole morality of the whole thing there, because they didn't do their due diligence. They didn't check and verify. And then also the claims that all this stuff was based on was based off of distorting the facts, because there's only one person in the building who's actually on a fixed income. Everybody else is not. And everybody else has jobs. Some of them are not working, but they're on unemployment. And up till, you know, yesterday, they were getting $600 per week, plus whatever their unemployment was. So they're getting close to $1,000 a week. And that hardly fits the category of a fixed income in terms of, oh my God, they're on a fixed income. We need to do this right here to protect them. And also, he's been here for 10 years. I've been here for 12 years. Everybody has known since we've been here that the whole plan was to take the building down. He's had 10 years to prepare himself to move. And every time I've talked to him, he's like, oh, I don't feel like it. It's too hard to, you know, too difficult to even think about that sort of thing. You know, we're all grown-ups, you know. I have diabetes. I have serious health issues. I've been seeing 7 doctors, you know. And so it's just completely unfair. And I think most of the people who have shown up here, you have a huge response. They've shown up because they genuinely care. And they were alarmed. People have been coming up saying, oh my God, are you okay? Can we help you? And it's all based on lies. And that's the unfortunate thing. I don't mind. If you are going to tell something, tell the whole story, tell the whole truth. Tell your thing, you know. Don't have, like, packages coming in 2-3 times a week that you're spending your money on and you're not saving money, you know. And then making it seem like it's the fault of the landowner, you know, who is giving you not only all the time that you've been here, because he's only had this for 2 years. Also, he told us nothing's going to happen this year, and then he'll give us 90 days notice once they know for sure anything is going to happen. Right now, we have 8 months notice. That's plenty of time for any adult to do the right thing. And so I think that most of the people came here with good intentions, and they don't realize what's going on. And so they think they need to support business, especially with all the protesting that's going on. They think they need to do this right here, and it's completely unfounded. And if they had known all these facts, you know, then they would have had a different opinion.
If you are just tuning in, my guest Rebecca Markley, a member of the North Portland Tenants Collective, and I are discussing the organization's fight to keep the Flanders House, an affordable housing option in Northwest Portland, from being demolished in the upcoming year. Can you talk about whether or not you or any of the members of the collective or even tenants that you're aware of have had any conversations with Gessner?
We haven't directly spoken with Gessner. We didn't particularly think that was like an important thing to do at the time. We were really focused on connecting with the tenants. We were really focused on learning the history of the building, because the public hearing was specifically about, it was in front of the Historic Landmarks Commission, and so we wanted to make sure that we were providing testimony that was relevant to the powers of the Historic Landmarks Commission. And so that's kind of what we were focused on, because we'd only really heard about the Flanders House disaster only a few weeks beforehand. So that's what we were really focused on. But we do plan to reach out to Elliot. I know during the testimony or during the hearing, he was a little bit upset that we hadn't reached out to him yet. But we really wanted to focus on making sure we had a good case for the Historic Landmarks Commission, because like that was the deadline. And now that that has been, I guess the Historic Landmarks Commission rejected the development plans, and they asked Enric Architects and Gessner to come back with a new take on some issues that they felt were important. So now we have a little bit more time, and we're going to go back and check in with Elliot.
So I believe the meeting was July 27th. So for that meeting, that recent historic landmark meeting, was the point of that to call for preservation of the Flanders House? What was the intent?
Our intent was to really delay the approval of the house or of the redevelopment. Based off of some kind of unfortunate situations, the house has not been, the house does not have as many like historical home protections as some of the other homes in the area. So it might have to go in front of city council, you know, it has a few more like layers of red tape around it. This one, just because of by nature being in the historic alphabet district, it does need to go in front of the Historic Landmarks Commission. And we were just trying to delay that, because that's really the only tactic that we have right now as far as preventing this from happening. And that is because in the 80s, the house was determined to be non-contributing, like a historic, like non-contributing house, not contributing to, I think, it's like architectural integrity. And I know we've spoken with Commissioner Derek Spears about what the commission is trying to do as far as re-examine that designation of architectural integrity, and really kind of like pull back and be a more like historical, cultural significance and not just architectural, because they realize that that specific architectural designation is packed with a lot of privilege and doesn't afford some spaces like the Flanders House, for example, at being made significant because, you know, it has experienced some, I guess, additions that are not completely, I guess, accurate to when the architectural style where the house or when the house was built.
And can you talk about, from the organization's, your organization's standpoint, has really emphasized that even before the pandemic, and many Portlanders are aware of this, there is a huge housing crisis, especially for low-income renters. Can you talk about how that particularly pertains to this house, and even more so during the pandemic, in terms of there being a shortage, and how, if eviction were to occur, what that means for various renters and their different experiences and needs?
Yeah, well, the owner of the building pointed out, the house is not, like, it's privately owned, so it's not public. It doesn't get those same sort of subsidies required, sort of like afforded, like entitled to those buildings. And so it's kind of, like I said earlier, by fluke almost, that this house has been able to remain so affordable. And I think that's because it's been kind of like on the chopping block for many years. You know, like the owner pointed out that there are tons and tons of repairs that need to happen. As an owner, I think it's absurd that he's bemoaning these repairs that he's, you know, put off for 2 years. And then the owner before him as well. I think that just kind of shows that developers have had their eyes on this, this lot of land for many years now. And kind of to speak to, like, the housing crisis, there are so many buildings in Portland that have empty units. And it's because, and they're just sitting empty because, you know, the market rate going rate for apartments is so much higher than what lots of people can afford as far as, you know, wages. And as wages have, like, has stagnated historically over the past, you know, 10, 20 years, you know, the prices of units in Portland have skyrocketed, and not keeping up with that, or completely, yeah, skyrocketed, whereas wages have remained stagnant. And so there are tons and tons of homes that are, you know, or apartments that are, you know, quote unquote market rate, but that market rate is so inaccessible to people that they, you know, have to sleep on the streets instead of just, like, have access to apartments that, you know, they could. And it's interesting that both the developer and many other people who I guess care about housing issues are like, eventually, you know, the market is going to catch up with all of the developers, and they are they're going to have to drop their rates. But the fact of the matter is that that's not happening fast enough. Like, the market to correct itself is sort of like still forcing tons and tons of people to move back in with their parents, you know, break their leases and be on the hook for thousands of dollars for their lease break fees.
It also assumes people have jobs, which many Americans do not right now.
Exactly. And it's so hard to even get approval for, you know, an apartment these days in Portland. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a quote unquote good employment history, you're currently unemployed. Like, what are the chances of you're even going to be allowed to even, like, rent in an apartment that you might be able to afford? So it's, I don't know, it's really dire. And I feel like, just like, again, waiting for the market to correct, so many people are losing out, and so many people are going to suffer because developers decide that right now, during a pandemic, is when we really need to be pushing forward my redevelopment plans.
After all those for and against the planned redevelopment of the housing site testified,
One of the owners, Elliot Gassner, responded that many of the testimony provided against the new building was organized by the North Portland Tenants Collective, and that since the group and those who testified did not reach out and speak with Gassner, many statements were made out of ignorance.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner Minor. I do have a bit of a prepared statement that I might make. And first of all, I just wanted to note that almost all the testifiers today were organized by the North Portland Tenants Collective. They never reached out to us as the ownership. They never requested to verify any information. So, but, you know, they're making a lot of claims without really understanding the nature of the situation. So, I just wanted to, I'll proceed through my statement as quick as I can. The building in question has been an example of natural affordable housing for decades. We, again, only purchased the property 2 years ago. It's not subsidized in any way. Rents are not stabilized. We have maintained the rents for the long-term residents as they were when we purchased the property, so we have chosen to not raise any of the rents. But since purchasing the property, it's become apparent that it has continued to be affordable as it is because previous owners failed to make necessary capital improvements for decades. So because of this, the current building is near the end of its useful life, and it cannot continue to be operated for an indefinite period of time. It will shortly require all the major renovations that have been deferred for all those years, which would necessitate vacating the building. So regardless of how we proceed, there would be it would be required to vacate the building in order to bring it up the month's end. So the roof segments, the foundation, all of the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems will need to be replaced shortly. The non-original siding contains asbestos, which also requires remediation. So our team did, as soon as we bought the property, did carefully evaluate renovating the current structure to see if it would be a viable option to operate in the future. Unfortunately, it has such a major deconstruction and then reconstruction effort, which would be very expensive, and the costs of which would be so significant that they could not realistically be supported by a building of that size and the potential rents that you would generate from that. So maintaining the status quo, you know, I'm very sorry to say, is of a naturally affordable SRO is simply not an option. So any owner would need to make necessary improvements to the current building and could not continue to operate it as it currently is. So, and I think as a few of my tenants indicated, we're extremely conscientious of the disruption to the residents' lives that redeveloping the building would cause. You know, unfortunately, we, like any other subsidized owner, don't have a choice. We have to proceed because the current building is not sustainable in the way it's currently operated. So we have done everything that we can to make this a good, and well, as good as process as it can be for our tenants. We've communicated well in advance. They've known about the potential redevelopment since before our DAR hearing in September 2019. And we're trying to provide as much transparency as we can. And I will note, of the 14 apartments in the building, only four are occupied by residents who've lived in the building for more than 3 years. Under our management, as I said, none of the rents have increased. When the redevelopment does proceed, those tenants would receive rental relocation assistance payments. And I plan personally on helping them find new homes. So I've already talked about that. I will dedicate as much time as need be to find them new places to live.
Through an email exchange with a tenant who has lived at the property for 10 years now and who wishes to remain anonymous, says the demolition of where he currently lives will have devastating impacts on his housing situation and overall health. He writes, quote, "It's sad that such a historic building is going to be demolished in the name of progress. Portland doesn't need more overpriced luxury apartments, especially when so many apartments sit empty. More than the number of homeless people on the street, I am given to understand. The loss of the Flanders House will be a loss of character in the Alphabet District, particularly because it is that rare affordable housing option in this part of the city. We need to maintain, not eliminate, affordable housing options. Two affordable housing options exist in the city as it is. Is there really any question why we have such a devastatingly large, unhoused community of people? If I'm being honest here, in the starkest of terms, gentrification is an evil force of greed and classism. There is no humanity in kicking people out of their homes for sake of the profit motive. As it stands, the way things are done is profit over people, end quote. I went on to ask about the effect this will have on the tenants' future housing and health, and here's what they wrote. Quote, I can only tell my own story. I am living on a fixed Social Security disability income of $800 a month. That's about $9,600 a year. I have been able to remain housed and stabilize my health due to affordable rent, which has remained at a manageable level for me for 10 years now. I am facing the possibility of homelessness. I have gotten on every low-income, affordable, and subsidized housing waitlist I could find, and I continue to seek out affordable housing options. But as anyone who has ever dealt with affordable housing knows, it's all about the waitlist. Waitlists move slowly, and it can take from 5 to 10 to 20 years to get into a building. I've been on Home Forward Section 8 waitlist for 6 years now, and I've got many more years to wait until a unit opens up for me. I'm afraid that availability isn't going to come quickly enough. Why does anyone think we have a homelessness crisis? It's because there's not enough subsidized housing for people when they need it. In the immediate term, upon being evicted, I will have nowhere to go that I can see, and I am currently looking for a cheap motel that offers monthly rates and long-term stays that I can afford. Health-wise, I live with a long list of conditions. The major one to note are HIV and AIDS, insulin-dependent diabetes, PTSD, and anxiety disorder. The housing upheaval that I'm facing could potentially seriously throw me off balance. To begin with, I need a refrigerator to store my insulin, and I take 15 prescription medications. Only with stable housing have I been able to keep a handle on my medication management and to remain stable overall. Waitlists are a long-term waiting game, and I hope to find a motel that I can stay in, as I mentioned. Finding a roommate situation or a room to rent from a homeowner is next to impossible online anymore. I'm looking, but I'm having no luck with roommate websites, and Craigslist appears to be mostly scammers at this point. I miss the good old days when you could put a flyer on a bulletin board in a coffee shop and make a great roommate connection with relative ease. And if you do manage to make communication with someone online, they will decide to ignore you, disregard you, devalue you, or quickly determine that you would not be able to be a good fit for their household when they hear you say the term fixed income. People have a lot of prejudice against the disabled who lived on Social Security. No one wants to live with a 50-year-old gay dude on disability with chronic medical and mental health issues. This is Claire Rosciato with KBOO News in Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.